Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. I serve as the publisher at AA Grapevine, and I'll be your host for the month of February. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meeting every Wednesday at noon Eastern Time on this virtual platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast every Friday on all podcast platforms and on YouTube. This is an open meeting. Everyone is welcome. We are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. If you are new to AA and want to learn more, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Talking to group members will help you to find a sponsor and help you to learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. This is today's daily quote from the AA Grapevine, February 4, 2026. I have had to face my past, one episode at a time, and become willing to look at the truth. I could feel the pain and fear like trolls under a bridge, waiting to jump out and challenge my self-esteem. That's from the article Facing the Truth from February 1993. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a special email. You can sign up at aagrapevine.org. Or you will find it on the app every morning. I wanted to read an excerpt from this month's Grapevine magazine. This is from the article Open Heart and Mind. Joanne starts out by saying that alcohol was my higher power for as long as I can remember. I yielded that power every waking moment. If I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking. It had power. It had control. It had me. That relationship was killing me, and I knew I had to get through the steps if I wanted to survive. And at the end, she goes on to say, that was many years ago. Through prayer and meditation, my faith has continued to grow. I'm afraid I don't have all the answers, but the beauty is that we all get to discover it for ourselves. Sobriety is amazing. When we open our heart and mind, the possibilities are endless. Let me start today with a reading from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is from the chapter More About Alcoholism. If you're new or here, curious about AA, this will tell you a lot about our affliction. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step of recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day do this, but it is yet to do so. Okay. This will be a two-speaker meeting. There will be no sharing by attendees, so please sit back, relax, and listen. I love to attend open meetings because there's no pressure, except for Anthony and Vera, of course. We often hear it is best to try to identify with the speakers rather than to compare your story with theirs. Our first speaker is Vera, and Vera has, I met Vera through service to AA. She was a director on the AAWS board while I've been working at Grapevine. And I am so pleased that she's been willing to start us off. This is our first open Grapevine meeting, and thank you for being one of our speakers, Vera. I'll give it to you.
Thanks, Chris. Hi, everyone. My name is Vera, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is September 19th, 1989. And my home group is the Sober on Saturday group that meets in Lee, Massachusetts, 8 o'clock Saturday morning. If you're ever in town, need a meeting, we'd love to have you. We do one of my favorite things after the meeting was go hang out and fellowship at the Starving Artist Cafe when we're done. And that's one of the things I love about my home group is that we do things outside of the home group, including having a service commitment at the local psych ward in Pittsfield. Thank you, Chris, and to all those who thought this was a good idea for me to show up today. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober, and I definitely love the Grapevine. Grapevine has been integral in my sobriety. My first 30, 40 days or so, I was introduced to a copy of the Grapevine at a point where I was in this program, and I had the attention span of a gnat. I could not read the big book. I couldn't focus on much, but the cartoons, the pictures, the graphics, the Grapevine really caught my attention. And there was a story in there that I immediately identified with, and so I have a fond place in my heart for the Grapevine. But before I got there, you know, I started drinking at a really young age, and I drank with, I like to say I drank with intention at 14. Like I had a mission, I had a goal, I was trying to get somewhere, and that was to get out of my body, to get out of this place, to get out of this space. And I drank because I liked what alcohol did. I did not drink for the taste of alcohol. I drank for that sense of ease and comfort. I just love saying those words. I drank for that sense of ease and comfort. And I enjoyed that feeling so much that I sought it more and more and more and more. And it got to a place where I needed it more and more and more. And, there were times when I understood that my drinking was harmful. But over time, I just ignored that knowledge. Right. I would, I just got to get the right mix. I need to do it at the right time. I need to have food on my stomach. All these little tactics I would try to manage and control my drinking. I love that section that you read, Chris, out of More About Alcoholism. The greatest obsession of every abnormal drinking is to try to control and enjoy their drinking. Those two things together, control and enjoy. Now, when I was trying to control my drinking, I was not enjoying it, right? Because I'm trying to keep the job, I'm trying to get back in the house, I'm trying to not get, I'm trying to, I'm trying to not face certain consequences, I'm trying not to lose, all that stuff. And I'm not enjoying it because I have all these parameters around it. And then when I was enjoying my drinking, I was out of control, out of control. And, eventually my alcoholic life seemed like the normal one, because being drunk and being high off alcohol became much more important than anything else in my life. And then I got to this point where I crossed this line, and it took me many years to understand what this line was that you folks talk about. Cross that line. What is that line? And I come to understand for myself that that line that I cross is I crossed a line from social drinking to obsessive compulsive drinking. Like once I took that first drink, I could not stop. Once I crossed that line, once I took that first drink, I could not stop. And I had little control over the amount that I drank after I drank, and I had little control over what happened to me after I drank. And then I experienced that obsession of the mind. Oh boy, that obsession of the mind, that preoccupation with thinking about drinking. Even when I had a half pint of whatever the flavor of the day was in my back pocket, I would be thinking about drinking, not running out, making sure I had enough, making sure there was more. Do they have it where I'm going? Do I really want to go if they don't have it? On and on and on, the constant thoughts, about protecting my drinking. I found out later, as I worked some steps with a sponsor and through the process of my first step, which basically was a conclusion of my lived experience with alcohol, I was not managing, controlling anything at all. But I found out, that's not what non-alcoholics do. That's not, normies, if you want to call them. I don't particularly like that word. I prefer the term non-alcoholics. They might have a drink. They may not even finish their drink. They may not even finish it. And they're able to stop, and they might get a little tipsy, and they're able to go on about their day. But me, once I took that first drink, I spent more money than I intended to. I went to places I did not intended to go, and I didn't come back when I intended to come back, and on and on and on and on. I could not stop drinking. And for years, I chased that sense of ease and comfort. And I was caught up in this illusion that, it'll be different this time. I won't drink till Friday, until I get off work. I'll just have two. And my favorite one is, you don't understand. You don't understand, right? Like if you lived in my world, in my life, if you were me, you would drink too, And then of course, I got this. I got this. And what happened is, after a bunch of car crashes and little, visits and interactions with the law and loss of jobs and this, that, and the other, I got to this place in my life where I ran out of options, right? I just ran out of options. Like alcohol was dictating daily what I did, where I went, who I went with, if I would even show up. It became my master, and it was the driving force in my life. And I found out with my sponsor and working for step that I had this relationship with alcohol. Check that out. I had a relationship with alcohol. And that relationship was so precious that I would protect that. That was my number one thing to protect above everything, above family, above friends, above even my very life. My very life. And so what happened is I just finally ran out of answers, right? I didn't know what to do. And through a series of events, I was led to you folks in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wound up going to a treatment. It was called a recovery home back in 1989 in San Jose, California. It was like 15, 20 miles outside of town. Perfect, right? Because I couldn't get to the liquor store. They didn't deliver. And nobody was coming to visit, so that wasn't an issue. And I heard people that thought like I thought, and they felt like I felt, and some of you actually drank like I drink, and some of y'all did what I did. And I started to see myself and hear myself and understand, and through looking at this book, being taken through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you'd use words like obsession, powerlessness, right? Denial, rationalization. That was a new vocabulary for me. I didn't know that those words. I just knew that I couldn't stop drinking. I just knew that I had a craving for alcohol, and I was unaware of anything other than that. And I finally got to a place where I entertained the possibility that maybe there was something different. Maybe there was something different. I remember someone standing up at the podium there talking about only 1 out of 10 of y'all gonna make it, or some ridiculous number they were saying. I got mad and I was like, that I'm gonna be that one. I think that's somewhere where my rebellion and defiance really helped me to like stay here. I'm gonna be that one. I don't like those numbers. I don't like those odds. And so I stayed. And I got a sponsor, and we started on this journey. And I would hear people in meetings talking about this process. Y'all love that word, process, process, process. Talking about this process of coming to. You came to believe. And I didn't know what any of that meant. But what I know for myself was I began to believe in the possibility of staying sober. That's what I began to believe in. Through the evidence of what I was seeing and the people that were showing up and the shares that I was hearing about people, I began to believe that maybe I could do something different. Because listening to you folks, I could see and I could relate to some of what you said and what you're doing, and I began to draw some hope. I began to draw some hope and have the possibility that maybe, just maybe, I could stay sober too. And so I started doing some of what you did, because you said, if you want what we have, then you do what we do. So I got a sponsor and we started this deal, this journey of going through the steps. And as the days turned into weeks and weeks turned into months, I began to experience some relief from my never-ending thoughts of drinking. Something was happening to me, not because of me, but in spite of me. And the more that I became open-minded and more willing, I became more hopeful. And I realized one day I hadn't thought about drinking. It's like, wow, what happened here? I used to think about this all the time. So I went through that process of the steps, and it changed my life. And I kept seeing evidence of this process working. And I kept seeing people and doing some stuff. And I began to find out some answers to two questions that really bothered me. Like, I didn't understand why I couldn't drink like I used to without getting drunk. That baffled me. Why can't I drink like I used to without getting drunk? And why, now that I want to quit, I can't stay stopped? And working with a sponsor and going to lots of meetings and listening to you folks explain and talk about some stuff, I began to realize and get some answers to those questions. And so going through those steps gave me a whole bunch of information about myself, and I like to say it produced a transformation, right? I began to take a real honest look about who I am, what I was doing, and deal with some of the stuff that I didn't want to deal with, because alcohol for me was like Calgon. I know I'm dating myself here. That old TV commercial, Calgon, bath oil beads, Calgon, take me away. That's what alcohol did for me, took me away. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I stayed. And I started to understand who I was and what I was and what was going on here. And my sponsor would say things to me like, AA is not just about meetings. This is a program of instructions. This is about alternative behavior. Do this instead of that. Let's look at some of your root causes, some of your patterns. You won't get drunk if you don't take the first drink. Bring the body and the mind will follow. She was talking a different language. I didn't know what any of that stuff meant. It didn't make any sense. Stick with the winners, but don't take anybody's inventory. How are you going to know who the winners are if you can't take it in somebody's inventory? That made no sense. So it was like gobbledygook, just all kinds of stuff. But I stayed. And I stayed because when I came in here, I had a shopping cart down Monterey Highway where I would pick up, go dumpster diving, and get what I could for my next drink. And like I said, I had gotten sick and tired of that life. I didn't want that life anymore. and you guys offered me a new life, something different. I realized that my anger and self-pity and fear under that was actually someone that I actually liked. That there was some, you know, I wasn't just this ball of anger and rage that I came in here with. I was so mad when I got here. I was mad at everybody, mad at myself, mad at you. Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. But sponsorship and unconditional love and Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Saved my life. I became aware of these behaviors and things that were rooted in fear. I didn't think I was fear. I had fear. I thought I was fearless. I'm driving 90 miles an hour, dancing naked on tabletops. That's fearless, fearless stuff. There's no fear here. No, no, no. And I thought, you know, doing the steps, I thought that was the level of insanity too. And I found out that's not really the insanity they're talking about either. The insanity that we're talking about is that curious mental twist, that thing that I tell myself to make it okay to take a drink, even when I know that that's not going to help, where it's going to take me, doesn't work, doesn't change. That was the insanity. I found out how I use my self-pity and my anger to manipulate people. And I found out through working through my resentments that the story I told about how much you were to blame for the things in my life that didn't work. It's your fault, your fault, your fault. The more I told that story, the bigger your part became and the smaller my part became, to the point where I had no part in it anymore. And the implication was, if it's your fault, then you have to fix it because it's your fault. So you fix it. And that was the beauty of working steps 4 and 5 with my sponsor. That I became 100% responsible for my life. I can go on and on and on about what I've learned and what I've gained in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll just kind of end it with, I don't know where the time is. Somebody will have to flag me because I'll talk forever about this thing that saved my life. I'll just end it on the part about, you know, this is a 3 legacy program: recovery, unity, and service. And it's the service and the good-hearted, unconditional love of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who said, come here, let me show you, not just by in the book, but through what they were living in their life going through. Let me show you how to do life one day at a time sober. And by the way, let's come over here and help set some chairs up. And when you're done, let's go get some coffee and make some coffee. And how about putting some literature over here in a rack? And I didn't know it, but what they were doing was introducing me to service, introducing me to how to do something for somebody else other than myself. Right? Because that's all I think about. That's all I got. And that unconditional love, that service to other alcoholics, doing something for somebody else without any strings attached, without any, you know, people came and gave me rides. I was 10, 15, whatever miles outside of San Jose, and people would come and pick me up and take me to meetings in town. They didn't want gas money. They didn't want anything. They just come and pick me up and took me places. And then they went to the meeting after the meeting and had the coffee and stuff, and I had no money. They didn't care about that. They said, whenever you get right, you pass it on to somebody else. And they were showing me a life of service, of unconditional love. And what I know today is that that service is an antidote to my selfish, self-centered, self-seeking behavior. When I'm able to step outside myself and do something for somebody else without any looking for anything, it really impacts my selfishness. It tamps that part down, right? Because at the core of my alcoholism is my self-centeredness. And so what I pay back to Alcoholics Anonymous is, to the best of my abilities, I do what was given to me as much as I can and show up in places like this when I'm asked. I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be sober, glad to be a part of this inaugural project of kicking it off. I'm sure that this is doing much more for me than it is for anybody else. I get to stay sober and I get to connect with people I love. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Vera. Great to hear you. Thank you. Just like you, I was drinking with intention at age 14, and I was a blackout drinker from the very start. It wasn't a whole lot of progress for me. I soon as I had a taste for alcohol and how it affected me, I wanted more and more, and I kept pursuing it. I also liked what you said about protecting your drinking. I used to bring a 12-pack to keg parties so that I would have extra in the woods, hidden in the woods in case it ran out, And I'm glad you stayed because AA is better having you with us. So thank you very much for your. I'm going to take a little break here. some announcements. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet that's called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix, and you can find that on AA.org. Grapevine, however, does not accept direct contributions, but of course, we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store on your phone. You can also purchase Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By buying at your local office, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and the local office. You can also visit the Grapevine online store at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message Project allows you to help others by providing magazines, subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour, which is available for free on all podcast platforms and on aagrapevine.org. And please follow us on Instagram and on YouTube. Our second speaker is my friend Anthony. Anthony and I have known each other since about 1996, probably 30 years or so. And he's been a great friend. He was my sponsor for a little while, and we've been to a lot of meetings together. We're both Yankee fans. We're both fans of the Grateful Dead, and we've spent a lot of time together over the past 35 years. And I'm grateful that he's here tonight to, or today, to speak to everybody. Welcome, Anthony.
Hi everyone, my name is Anthony. I am an alcoholic. Chris, it's so great to see you. And Vera, thank you so much for your great story. I really appreciated listening to you. And I think it's wonderful that we all have similar stories. We all come from different places and different backgrounds, but our common sense of unity is in our stories and in our recovery from alcoholism. I wanted to just put a little plug in for the Grapevine myself. I enjoyed it when I first got my first copy. I loved the cartoons, Victor E. and Ham on Rye. I'm like a little kid at heart. So when I came in, I was just starting over really. I too, was in drinking in earnest when I was 14. Although I can remember my first drunk was maybe I had just learned to walk, and my grandfather loved to drink his wine, and he would put a saucer of wine out for me and give me a piece of bread to dunk in it. And I think that's where my addictive personality started, both with alcohol and with food. It would dip the wine in the bread in the wine, and I would eat it. And I even my mouth waters just now, just the way it tasted. It's just this explosion of sweet and burn and all of that. And of course I wanted more. you know, and he laughed and he gave me more and more until, you know, the inevitable, what happens when you're an early drinker, you know, you drive the porcelain bus and get sick. And my grandmother was so angry, so angry. And I remember sleeping it off. And I remember, you know, hearing, you know, don't say anything to your mom, or, you know, and I was sick. You know, my mom came and got me and I was sick. Later on, we shared a can of beer, a warm can of Ballantine. That's dating me. And I remember the warm feeling, and I proceeded to go up to the neighbor's lawn and dig up their lawn with my Tonka trucks. In denial right away, you know, oh, that wasn't me. You know, I didn't do that. You know, they had some fresh grass they had planted, and I went in there and I left my trucks there. I never went back. You know, it was just total, you know, that wasn't me. And then later on in life, when I went to parochial school and one of my teachers brought in someone to speak about AA. And I remember, meeting someone, and my teacher's husband evidently had been in the program and newly sober. And I'm talking back in 1974. Anyhow, when we graduated from grade school or eighth grade or junior, what do they call it? Junior high. We got a case of beer and we split it five ways. And I did the math and I said, I'm not going to be the guy that gets one less beer, you know, the 24 beers. And so I proceeded to drink all the beers. And then they said, well, let's go home. And I was like, wait a minute, we still have beer. You didn't drink all your beers. We got to finish the beer. And where are you guys going? Anthony, because they had their education, I think you're an alcoholic. I was like, oh, come on, guys, you know. I was called an alcoholic right away. I had a lot of stuff going on in my life, emotional stuff. My parents had divorced or were going through a divorce. I had, things were tight. I had a job. I came from parochial school, so I had this great education, I felt, and I did. I was I and I wanted to go to and advance in a Catholic boys school, but we couldn't afford it. It was expensive at the time, and I won a scholarship at a place in the Bronx, I'm in Westchester County, New York, which is not far from New York City and Yankee Stadium, as Chris mentioned. We're pretty close. In fact, we have a train stop now. That's awesome. But back then I got ran a I got a scholarship to Hayes, and I was just a deal breaker because I had to get up so early in the morning, and plus, you know, I would go to the public school and I could party. So that's what I ended up doing. I was on the honor roll the first year, my freshman year. I was a football player. I ended up getting a job in the summer of 1977, at the end, I went to my first concert and started partying on a regular basis. A lot of those dry goods and different things that goes along with growing up in the 70s. And then I went to my first Dead show, September 11th, 1977. I'm sorry, September 11th. September 3rd, 1977 was the Englishtown, New Jersey. Like, if you were from New York and you even liked the Deadhead, everybody was at that show. It's like 180,000 people. Anyway, first day of school was the next day. Guess who didn't show up? Guess who didn't show up most of the year? 10th grade, I had an incomplete. So I went from honor roll to not showing up at football practice to not playing football to dropping out of school in 10th grade. Now, you can't drop out of school in 10th grade. You have to be signed out by your parents. And there was no control on me at that point. I really was a very angry child, child, I guess, a teenager, and partied on a regular basis. You know, I went to work. I got a job in the trade that I'm in now. I went on to excel in it, really. I had some background in electronics, and I worked on heating systems, so you know, it was something that I enjoyed to do. And but you know, the alcohol was always in the way. You know, I didn't think that I was a morning drinker until I realized that just a little bit of anisette inside your coffee in the morning wasn't morning drinking, you know. But you know, it went from just a little bit to a mug, you know, with a little bit of coffee, and then I usually made it through the day. But you know, at 5 o'clock, even back then, it was socially acceptable. The boss had a soda machine with ice cold Budweiser, and at 5 o'clock, even if you were working after five, you know, you could drink. And that was, you know, I have a very short drinking story, but it was a very hard drinking story for 9 years. My highlights were, you know, I had proceeded to, you know, go down a path where I would alienate everyone around me. I was the type of guy that would go to the bar and unplug the jukebox and say, "Hey, I want to drink alone in a crowded bar," and proceed to fight everybody. The scariest thing that happened, it's kind of comical now. I can laugh at it now, but back then I had been on a bender, and a girl called me on the phone, and I lit a cigarette in my bed while I was, you know, in bed, and I passed out with the phone still here, you know. And and I lit my bed on fire. I, you know, the whole thing was smoldering on the side. And of course that creates all kinds of smoke. And my mother came in and said smoke, 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 smoke. So I proceeded to take my mattress. I put it out on the, I leaned it against the telephone pole. And I proceeded to go back out and drink, came back, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning. That's when bars close here in New York. I don't know if it still do, but, and then passed out. About an hour or two into my sleep, the doorbell's ringing, and it's the fire department asking me if it was my mattress that lit the telephone pole on fire. There you have it, right? So so that's kind of the depth of my alcoholism. I really truly believed I had a death wish. I did not know I had a death wish, but I did kind of have like visions of not making it to my next birthday. You know, some scary things. I had my sister in the car, and I was smoking some of those dry goods, and I proceeded to cough and cough so hard that I blacked out, you know, going 70 miles an hour in the left lane. And then waking up and looking at all the cars behind me, piling up, and, you know, drunks and cats, right? You know, they have seven lives. I missed that whole thing. I just driving along in this pileup that I caused afterwards. I drove away. I met a girl, and she had a black belt in Al-Anon. Her father was in the program. And she told me about AA, and I, you know, it was very curious to me, and I tried to white knuckle it because I wanted the girl, right? And I came here for the girl, and so she introduced me to a guy. We were talking about him earlier. Chris was saying that he submitted a Grapevine article this month, Jack B in Florida. He's not in Florida, but back up, you know, we're up here. And we went to dinner, and after dinner, I had asked him, she had suggested to me that, you know, talk to him about it if you're that curious. And I did. And he sat me down. You know, we were in his office, private conversation, and he told me all about how AA really, you know, changed his life. And, I told him that I had this constant gnawing in my stomach, you know, like always like upset, always in the time we say agita, I had this constant agita. And he said that he went to AA and he started doing the steps, and the steps helped him to connect what was stuffed way down here in his mind and helped somehow fill a hole in his soul. And I was just like, wow. When can I go? And it just so happened there was a meeting in about a half an hour. And he said, well, it was just one and a half an hour. It's like, tonight? I don't know about tonight. You see, I got plans. So still, I kind of floundered a little bit, but not too long after that, I was going to lose the girl. And I came, one of those 3-day, benders. And then you're kind of sleeping in the next day. And he asked me for help on something. I think it was this dishwasher, hooking up a dishwasher or something. And I went to his house and he took one look at me. He was like, whoa, can I get you an aspirin or something? And I was like, yeah, nah, I know I gotta stop. And I said, well, you want to go to a meeting? I was like, yeah. And it was like noontime, right? And he's like, well, there's a meeting at 12:45. You want to go? I'm like, oh, all right. I can't get away for this. So I went to my very first meeting. Early in my life, I was a Boy Scout, and I really loved the outdoors, and I really loved like the whole, mentorship thing that was going on there. My dad was not a big part of my life. He was he had his own demons to exercise, I guess. So the Boy Scouts were very appealing to me. Well, the first meeting was like no other meeting that you go to. Maybe in Western Massachusetts you have them like this, but here in New York, in Westchester County especially, this meeting was called Noon Unity, and I think it's still around. But they used to meet on Sparkle Lake in it's almost like on the Somers Yorktown border, and it was a lake like swimming hole, beach thing, part of the town. Recreation, and they were able to use their kind of meeting house overlooking the lake in the winter. And it was September, I'm sorry, it was January, it was cold out, and the snow was on the trees, and the lake was frozen somewhat as like your background there, Vera. And the big picture window overlooking the lake, and it was warm, and it was a fire going in a fireplace, and it was this old timer stoking the fire in the fireplace, and there was a smell of coffee was in the air, and laughter, and little kids, because it was a daytime meeting, and they had like the kids went off in another room with somebody watching them while the parents had needed a meeting, and they welcomed me. At that point, I had alienated everybody. I was barred from the bars. And they welcomed me, and they said, I really appreciated the warmth in the room. I truly know now that that was really the grace of God coming through everything and everybody in that room. But for me, it was just this emotional joy that I felt. And I looked at the steps on the wall and looked past the first step, and saw that came to believe that power greater myself would restore me to sanity. And I identified with that. I was the guy that would go to the city and to buy drugs and, climb up to the fourth floor with the guy and then walk across the roofs and come down in another building and with guns and all this insanity and just, drunken driving and crashing cars and fighting with people that could have had guns. And I knew that my behavior was crazy. I knew that I needed to be restored to sanity. And of course, not too long after that, I joined a group. It was 12 and 12 in Mohegan Lake. Actually, Jack was one of the guys that was a founder there. He was not my first sponsor because of the association. His wife and my son's mother were very close, so that he thought it was inappropriate. I think that was pretty smart. But not too long after that, I got a sponsor. I was at a beginner's meeting. I started my 90 meetings in 90 days. I found out later they had bets. Like, I don't know about this guy. I don't know if he's going to make it. This is a tough case here. I was the guy sitting in the front with the ashtray and burned the styrofoam cups. I was that guy, But I got a sponsor. you know, I was at a beginner's meeting, and I figured, I'll just call him on it during the meeting. All right, well, why don't you be my sponsor? And he says, all right, let's talk after the meeting. I'm like, what did I get myself into? And he told me, and you know, at that meeting, I heard, you got to get a group, and you got to get a sponsor. And there were five things you could do to keep yourself sober, you know, every day. It was to wake and pray, read your 24-hour day book, call your sponsor, go to a meeting, and then thank God at the end of the night, right? And then one day at a time, I might not drink. Now, that was January 1986. So I just celebrated my 40th year. And I got onto the thank you. Yeah, I got onto the, you know, ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. So just to kind of dovetail on what Vera talked about, you know, the ABCs of the program, you know, and I took great pride in coffee, you know, the C in chairs or coffee. I would make the coffee for the group and make sure that it was great. And if somebody complained, oof, I really would be upset about that. I didn't do well at business meetings, so I didn't really get involved in service as much as I could have. But I will say that the same guy, Jack, took me along on a lot of different things, and he was the GSR for our group, and I was the alternate GSR. I had a year, and I remember AA coming alive there for me. The biggest thing that happened back then is when they were writing the 24-hour, our daily reflections. There was a big controversy about having literature and at the same table as the 24-hour day book. So AA decided to write their own, and there was a sheet that we brought back. And the fellowship was relatively small back then, not the way it is now, and not mainstream the way it is, of course, today. But we took that that sheet home and to the home group, and you know what? Two members from our group got three pages in a daily reflection. I was just flabbergasted about that. I couldn't believe that AA was this upside down triangle, and there were no bosses, and the groups ran the meeting, and they truly would vote on things, and it would kind of fumble its way down to, you know, the General Service Office. And I visited the General Service Office on Park Avenue, and I remember, you know, meeting the archivists, and kind of all of a sudden, it all just started to come together for me. You know, I remember reading early on, one of the other books was Pass It On that came out. And in Pass It On, I remember hearing like the key to the program. And Bill W. had said that, you know, we have a kind of a reset to start our day over at any time, get down on our knees and pray. And through that prayer, we could start our day over at any time. And that concept of one day at a time, and then 1 minute at a time, when I was really struggling, was a principle that I learned early on and loved. And I remember also put one foot in front of another to just kind of move a muscle, change a thought. I had a lot of noise in my head. I had a judge and jury. It was something that really needed to be all sorted out. And by having a sponsor and being able to share all of these things was so valuable to me. You know, it was like this advisor in life. And the only reason he did it, I didn't even have to pay him. And it even, you know, it was because somebody did it for him. You know, just pay it forward is what he said, as Vera mentioned earlier. And I tell you that I wrote my four step with intent. Back then, a lot, I guess my sponsorship train, we did it in 5-year increments, and to write an honest and accurate autobiography. I had to write it, dear God, help me to write an honest and accurate autobiography, to learn from it, not to be hurt by it. And I wrote that down on, I don't know, I think it was probably, you know, a dozen or so pages. And I later sat down with my sponsor and went over my story. And he had out his list of defects, and he told me, you know, and he kind of just started checking things off and stopping me and trying to explain a little bit of what was going on, you know, and maybe to help me to figure out the exact nature of my wrongs. And mostly it was that I had God-given instincts that had basically gone awry. I learned that in the 12 and 12. In the first page of the fourth step, they talk about that. They say that we have an instinct that is God-given. We have instincts of social to be, you know, amongst friend and be and have notoriety and have self-esteem. The other was to have a roof over our head, the security instinct, the social instinct, the security instinct, a roof over our head and food on the table, and a place to and then the sexual instinct to reproduce, and any of those things go awry when the defects of character come on. And in particular, to deep dive on 6 and 7, you know, early on, my sponsor was just like, "You want to hold on to any of this? You know, do you want to have God remove them entirely?" And I was like, "Of course, you know, at the end of your fifth step, you know, you'll just like anything, right? To get better, to get behind that." And so he said, "Go home and pray." And I remember saying, wait a minute, that's 7, isn't it?" He's like, "Didn't we just briefly talk about 6? He goes, "Relax." I said, "You take home this list and you pray on it. And every day you call me and you can tell me that usually when things are not going your way, one of these defects are prevalent in the situation. And then you're going to pray to have them removed. But God will help you move mountains. You had better bring a show. So don't be surprised if you pray for patience and God puts you on a long line to practice." and then things like that would happen where, you know, I would see little God moments in my life. And I got to the point where my favorite slogan was "Expect a miracle," because I would see there's just way too many coincidences, you know, that those things that there was not some sort of, you know, supreme being in the world around me, and with that intention, that, you know, I became a pessimist and turned into an optimist. Later on, I will tell you, I did more of a deep dive. I got a new sponsor, Billy D, and now he's down in I think it's in North. Oh no, he's in Virginia, and he asked me to do a deep dive on the on my steps, on my defects. He gave me a list. I wrote down all the definitions, and then I prayed to really, really learn them and really, really internalize them. The seventh step prayer, instead of saying, you know, "God remove for me every single defect of character, the character of greed, you know, or lust or pride or, you know, control or all of those things." And he taught me a drill. And the drill was, anytime things are going along the way that it, you know, kind of just seem like something's not right, you know, something that's not going well, pause. And the pause and ask, "What is this? What's driving me right now?" Well, I will tell you, most of the time it's control, it's judgment, you know, it's intolerance. And then pray. So it was pause, ask the question, identify, and then pray and ask for it to be removed, and then do some sort of service. And I had to do that, you know, every single day for 30 days, 3 times a day, do that prayer. And then I learned the action afterwards. And it's in stopping and pausing, really, and just maybe simply just breathing. And then identifying that I'm going through something, ask for some help, and then pray. And that's really like 10, 11, and 12. Now, I will say, in between all of that, you know, I don't want to skip over 8 and 9, but, you know, I had a lot of making up for with my sisters and the and my family, and it had to be a living amends. It had to be getting closer. You know, my mom, she just passed away, and my dad, you know, 5 years or 6 years prior. I really had an awful relationship with my father. And, you know, it was a type of situation where, you know, he would look at me side-eyed and at family functions, Christmas and all of that, until eventually we started doing things together, you know, obviously over the span of like 35 years, we started getting closer. And, you know, on his deathbed, I became his confidant. It was almost like being a sober son, being a sober brother, being a sober boss, being a sober friend. But to him, it was able to almost do like a fifth step with me. And we got that level of closeness that we were able to do that. And to me, that was the ultimate in my step nine. I became a seeker. I've done many different modalities. You know, I started out with my Catholicism and that part of religion. And then I started learning many spiritual principles. It would be, you know, I have to mention shamanism, where all of these guides all over the world somehow met with these indigenous tribes everywhere, and they all have a common theme. There's no coincidence in that. Wow. You know, they had a spiritual advisor in most of the tribes. They believe many of these things, and there's such a common thread through all of those things. And also, you know, just the vibration, and we are who we are, and how that molecularly, you know, down to the atoms, that we are really just in a, you know, there's a lot of space and a lot of air in between all of that, and we are all energy. And that through Reiki, I learned that I was not, you know, that God wasn't around me, that eventually he could be a channel that could come through me, and the light could come through me. And that's really what the program teaches us. You know, so that in our 10th step and in our 11th step, to become a seeker and let God work through us and let that spirit work through us. And then in the end, you know, the 12th step, just to carry it on. You know, I have other guys in my life where I take care, you know, I help them and then they pass it forward. And I don't want to keep on going on and on, but I can. And I hear that in the grapevine, they had a joke in there. I missed it. But, you know, Chris was telling me the other day is that there's a new 12-step program for people who talk too much. It's called On and On and On and On. Anyway, so, you know, thank you so much. And just my quick plug, $3 a month, the grapevine. Where could you, come on, $3 a month. Sign up for the app, will you please?
Thank you, Anthony. I'll have to give you a cup of coffee or something for that little plug. Thank you. I could definitely identify with your early drinking. I was the guy that got the case, you know, and made sure we had the case in order to keep it going. And I too, now looking back, I realize I think I had a death wish. I mean, just I certainly didn't want to be conscious, you know. I wanted to get away from life for sure. And you know, you're talking about the sponsor, and you know, when I sponsor people, I always have to tell them that, you know, they're so grateful, and I'm like, you know, it's you're helping me as much or more than I'm helping you. And I do this because you know, I don't want to drink. So thank you very much. And I'm just going to invite Vera to close the meeting with the prayer of her choice.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Anthony. It was wonderful to meet you and get to hear your story. I would close with the serenity prayer after a moment of silence for the alcoholics who are suffering in and out of the rooms and around the world. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. And the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Vera. Thank you, Anthony. Right. Thanks, you, Chris, for everyone who attended today. And we'll be here every week at noon. Hope to see you again next week. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.